Welcome, dear listener, to Let's Dig Deeper, the podcast where we talk all about archaeology, history, art, and culture. My name is Zinat Haroun. I am a student of classical archaeology here at the University of Copenhagen. And in this podcast, I'm going to take you along for interviews with some of the delightful people working in the field. And we'll talk with archaeologists, historians, and professionals working in the field. And hopefully, we'll learn more about the past in the process. Today, I'm joined by the wonderful Christina Winter Jacobsen. Welcome to the studio, Christina.
Thank you very much.
And Christina, you are a lecturer of classical archaeology here at UCPH. You have a PhD from Cambridge and you've been the director of the Danish Institute in Athens. You're an expert in ancient ceramics and you research pottery as a proxy for understanding human life and activities, and you have a wide knowledge of ancient Greek society and art. And today's topic is ancient Athens. And we're styling this episode a bit differently than usual, where we're going to be doing a tour through ancient Athens and talk about some of the absolute highlights of the city and what you, our listener, should make sure to visit when you're there. And you're going to be our audio guide through ancient Athens today, Christina. So before we fully start our tour, I think we should start by clarifying why Athens is so important to archaeologists and ancient historians. I mean, we return to the city over and over again, and it's famous for being the cradle of democracy, and the architecture is amazing, of course. But what is it that keeps drawing us back to Athens?
It's many things that draw us back to Athens. I think first and foremost, it has to do, of course, it has to do with the fact that we have many written sources. So it's a city that is known. We have detailed knowledge of the history of this city, more particular from some centuries than others, but nonetheless, so you can get very close to personalities. Everybody knows about Socrates. So everybody knows about people who walked the streets of ancient Athens. That's the one thing. The other thing is that because of the history of Greece, Athens was, during the Ottoman Empire, Athens was a small and insignificant town. And the Greek Revolution almost destroyed Athens. So when Athens was finally made the capital city of the new nation state, quite a large part of the center of the city, which is in fact the old town, was made into an archaeological park. So that has given us unique opportunities, of course, to explore Athens, because when you think about most capital cities, although they pretty much all have archaeology underneath, it's not so easy to get to. So I think that these are two of the reasons that are wonderful written sources, but also extremely well-preserved and accessible archaeology.
All right, and with that clarified, let's dig deeper. So, we land in Athens. We're at the edge of the city, it's sunny, it's warm, and atop one of the hills we get a glimpse of some large marble structures. And this is the goal of our journey, and we decide to start making our way there. On the outskirts of the ancient city, we pass through Kaimaikos, what used to be the ancient potter's quarter, and a large part of it also functioned as a necropolis or a graveyard, and some of the grave monuments there catch our eye. What could you see at Kaimaikos in antiquity, and what is still left there today?
So when you go to Kaimaikos today, it's a very lovely situation because, of course, you're in the middle of this huge city with millions of people. And the Kaimaikos is very much like an open museum. It's an open area. And the excavation has kind of reconstructed the landscape. So you get an impression of what it was like. The excavation itself, done by the German Institute at Athens, is divided into a part that is inside the city walls and the part that is outside the city walls. And this is this necropolis that you mentioned. And there you actually get a really nice impression of what it would be like if you had arrived in Athens. So you would have arrived on the road, maybe from Eleusis, you would have arrived on the Sacred Road, or you would have arrived on one of the other roads. And as you were walking towards the city, the closer you get to the city wall, you would have more and more grave monuments. So in this area, in fact, there have been burials since the 3rd millennium. So it's a very old necropolis. But of course, in the early years, Athens wasn't one city. It was a lot of smaller settlements with small necropolis. But as smaller settlements got collected into one city, the custom of having the burial or disposing of the dead outside of the city walls became more and more dominant. And the roads towards the city became the focal areas of the grave grave monuments, because as you were approaching the city, you would be able to mourn collectively your dead. So families would have grave plots with grave monuments, and there they would use sculpture, epigraphy, so poems, to reach out to the people traveling by and get a response. Look at our wonderful and beautiful and much missed dead, and mourn them with us. So it would have been a very powerful experience as you walk through, and you would have all these grave monuments. If you were walking in the fourth century, you would have all these grave monuments aligning the road with all these faces and members of the family. So it would have been a very powerful experience.
And some of the really great monuments there, what were they?
So they're all different ones. There are private ones and there are public ones, which is part of why the Kerameikos necropolis is especially interesting, because of course all around the city wall there would have been necropolis. So Kerameikos is just one of them, and it happens to be the one that's excavated to this high standard. There are others. But the Kerameikos one was especially important area because it also became the area of the Demotion Sema, which is the public necropolis. Because in the classical period, the democracy made a change to the way that soldiers would be buried. So if you died during war, fighting for Athens in this case, instead of being buried in the battlefield, you would be cremated at the battlefield and transported back to Athens, and all the dead soldiers would be buried together. Now, this is something to do with the fact that during democracy, Athens became a very powerful city, and it fought long wars far away, which meant that the families couldn't really retrieve the bodies. It would be very difficult for families to retrieve the bodies. So instead, the state took over that responsibility, the state as in the polis. They also, of course, if you fight wars in Egypt, you cannot bring back bodies on sailboats. So they cremated the bodies in the battlefields and brought them back. And then once a year, there would be this ceremony where 10 coffins, each tribe, the ashes of the dead soldiers from that tribe. There would be a portices, which is actually, it's a burial custom that also comes from the private families, so that before you bury the dead, you get to go to their house and say goodbye. And in a sense, this ceremony would replace that, so that the families could come and everybody could come and leave small presents and say goodbye to the dead. And then they would be buried, and they would be buried together in these state burials. And that's why, obviously, those burials are quite prestigious. So this area, you know, important families would obviously choose, it would be more prestigious to have their burials in this area. So that's part of the reason. But also the sacred road, which is the road that leaves, well, it takes us to Elefsina, which is the home of the very famous Demeter sanctuary. And because there used to be a procession walking from Athens to the Demeter sanctuary, this was a very important road. That's why it's called the Sacred Road. And obviously, this was more prestigious as well. So the prestigious families would have their graves in these important areas.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then we make our way from Kerameikos and then into the city beyond the city wall. And we follow the path or the area of this Demotion Sema and the road sort of laying it out for us. At one point, we reach this big sort of open space where people are milling about, trade is happening. And this is the Agora, the ancient Athenian forum. And archaeologists often create a triangle of Athenian society between the Acropolis, which was the religious center, the Pnyx, which was where the public assembly would meet, and then the Agora, which was the political and economic center and a trade hub. And what is it that makes the Agora so interesting?
The Agora is interesting because of the many functions that it has, but also because of its, the specific one, because of its history, because it didn't used to be in the location where the famous classical Agora is. It used to be on the east side of the Acropolis. So the east side of the Acropolis in the archaic city was a much more important area, partly to do with the location of the harbour. You know that Athens has a harbour city. It's not located itself on the sea, although the sea is very important. It's pulled back a little bit. And at Fallon, it had the important harbor. And Fallon is closer to the area east of the Acropolis. So that's where the core of the ancient city was during the Archaic period. But during the Classical period, when democracy was founded, they actually moved the political center of the town to this new agora on the northwestern side, which is much closer to the Kyrmaikos and the city gates on the western side of town. The area had already partly been explored, probably for more commercial purposes. In the 6th century, Athens is a growing city, and it's a city that has ambitions. So they need more space. And this new area is developed probably initially for commercial purposes. But when in 508-07 the democracy is founded, they need to build new institutions, and they place these in the agora. So the agora is partly the political heart of the city, but it's also a very important commercial place. As time goes by, the commercial aspect is less and less, and it moves away from the agora. But initially, it's very much a combination of the two. Obviously, from a democratic point of view, the agora is particularly interesting because this is where the architectural language of the civic city is developed. Because when the democracy is founded, it's the first of its kind. Monumental architecture in the ancient town was pretty much religious architecture, and there was no proper civic architectural language. The democracy obviously had some civic bodies, some institutions, and they needed a physical space and a physical form. And these buildings were placed in the agora, and this, of course, is a very important process. So it's the Bouleuterion, which is the meeting place of the Council of 500. It's the Prytaneion, which is the house of the sort of the executive committee of the Council of 500. It's the Boule, let's call them that. It's a bit shorter. And it's the Stor Basileus, which is the office of some of the most important civil servants. So all of these democratic institutions found new homes in the agora, but they had to design buildings for that purpose. And what they did was they drew on the sacred architecture. If you had walked around Athens in the 6th century, columns, you know, Doric and Ionic columns that we know that they're so common, even in our own civic architecture, would have been a characteristic of the sanctuaries. But this language was used to dress up the new democratic institutions, obviously in order to borrow from the power and provide legitimacy to the democratic institution. So this is a very interesting period of time when there's a unique opportunity, a new opportunity to develop on the architectural language. And the way that they progressed really was to imbue the architecture with the powers of the sacred world. So part of the reason why the agora is very interesting.
Well, it's definitely a very significant one because, as you say, this is where democracy maybe perhaps physically took form. Actually for the first time, right? And the agora centered around the Panathenaic Road, which was used during the incredibly important Panathenaic Festival, which then ended back up at the Acropolis. And what was this festival? Why was that a significant thing?
So the gods are extremely significant in the ancient world. Sometimes it's hard for modern people to understand because our lives are very different. But in the ancient Greek world, the gods were present in all facets of human existence, both in terms of communities, but also in terms of individuals. So it's about guiding, supporting, protecting communities and individuals. But it's also, as in the case of the democratic architecture, it provides legitimacy and consensus to decisions. So the gods sanction things. And in Athens, the name really says it all. The patron goddess, of course, is Athena. So Athena protects Athens and the citizens of Athens. The festival, it celebrates Athena by commemorating one of her most important roles among the gods, is her part in the war between the gods and the giants. For this celebration, as is common in the Greek world, there are competitions. So we know that from the Olympic Games, and there are many games, but the Olympic Games are probably the more important ones. So what happens is that there will be all these competitions, not only in sports, but also in poetry and in music. So this coming together and competing and showing off is a really important part. The Athenian or the Greek culture itself is really an excellence culture with a very, very strong competitive element. And the winners, obviously, the honor of winning is everlasting, but you also get a prize. So you get olive oil from the groves of Athena herself. So there is actually a prize that also has monetary value. But the most important part of the festival is the sacrifice to Athena. And the sacrifice starts with a procession that meets in the Kerameikas outside the city walls and then walks towards the Acropolis, across the Agora and up onto the Acropolis. And it's, of course, the priests, priestesses, winners, sacrificial animals, and then selected members of the 10 tribes. So during the democracy, 10 new tribes were actually organized. So every Athenian, and we must remember that Athenians technically lived all over Attica. So the citizens of Athens, they were organized in 10 tribes. And those 10 tribes had to select members to participate in this very prestigious procession.
Representatives, basically, right?
Yes, to walk up to the Acropolis and, you could say, reconfirm the bond between Athena and Athens. So it's a very important event for the Athenians, and it's part of the close relationship that you establish with the gods to get their protection, basically.
And in the area of the Agora, you can also find the Temple of Hephaestus, which is amazingly well preserved, unlike the Olympiaion, which we'll talk about in a minute. Both at Kerameikas and the Agora, we find these white marble monuments, and also all over the ancient worlds in general. What is it about white marble as a material that made it the go-to for sculptures and monuments?
First of all, it's the local material. So it's available, which is always a good argument. But it has special qualities. So marble is crystalline limestone. Because of the crystals, it's incredibly bright and it allows light to permeate the surface, which makes it a very beautiful material to look at in the sun. The high quality marble is hard and fine grained, which makes it possible to make really delicate sculpture and architectural decoration and extreme forms. So that's why, you know, it's available, but it also has the characteristics that really allow you to explore forms. And it can be painted easily and it can be polished so that it's an incredible shine. So in that respect, it's an excellent material for anything you want to cut that is delicate. It goes all the way back to the Neolithic period because it is the local fabric. But it's really in the Cyclades, in Paros and Naxos, two of the islands which had really high quality marble, that there in the 7th and 6th century, the potential of the material became obvious. And from there, so in the beginning, if you wanted to make a temple, especially if you wanted to make sculpture, you would import it from Paros or Naxos. Now, the Athenians were very lucky because in the Archaic period, they discover rich deposits of high-quality marble at Pentelikon, a mountain that is, I think it's 20 kilometers actually, from the core of Athens, but it's still very close by.
Closer than Paris.
Absolutely, and you don't have to cross the sea. So it was quite convenient. And when those deposits were discovered, and especially in the classical period, after the destruction of Athens and new building programs, it was Pentelic marble, which was the go-to material. But it's also a very beautiful material. And Greece is still a great exporter of marble. But Pentelic marble had to be reserved only for the restoration of ancient cultural monuments. So today, for instance, if you go to the Acropolis and you will see the restoration program, this is actually the same marble from the same location. But it is a problem that they exploited all the high-quality stone. So high-quality marble, huge blocks, very rarely comes around. And in fact, in the restoration program, when they're working on the Parthenon, already back in the 80s, in the quarry, they were able to produce a block that weighs 12 tons. It's the heaviest block in the Acropolis. So it's the lintel of the door of the Western cellar in the Parthenon. And obviously they knew that eventually they would get to this point, and they were able to produce this block. So it was brought to the Acropolis and it was left on the floor. It's been sitting on the floor for this many years. All of the equipment in the Acropolis was designed specifically so this weight could actually be carried and transported the block. Because everybody knew that this is going to be the pinnacle. This is the most heavy block that we will be able to move, or we will need to move. And they've now entered this phase. So they are taking apart the Western cellar wall and they will be putting up this lintel of the original material that has been waiting all those years to be put in place.
And not far from the Agora, then, is the Olympiaion,
yes,
which was this monumental temple to the Olympian Zeus. And in contrast to the temple of Hephaestus, not very much remains of this ancient structure. But can you still maybe tell us a little bit about its history?
So the reason why that is a very interesting temple is because Athens was destroyed in 479, the pre-classical period is poorly preserved. And this temple was built in the pre-classical period. It was built by the sons of the tyrant Pisistratus when he died in honor to honor their father. And it is huge. And although it's not well preserved, but you can see the foundations and then you can see columns on the ground from a much later version of this temple. And the thing is that this temple would have been completely unique if it had ever been finished. It wasn't finished during the archaic period, but it would have been unique because it's more than 100 meters long. So it belongs to a type of very rare mega monuments, so to speak, these enormous temples that are associated with the tyrants in Asia Minor, these very wealthy cities in Asia Minor. And it shows the ambitions of the Pisistratids and the ambitions of archaic Athens to become a leading polis. I mean, there are no other temples of this size in the Greek mainland or the Peloponnese, and no one ever attempted to build in this area such a large temple again. So it's an extreme bid to enter into this hugely privileged, rich world of the Ionian cities. Because, of course, Athens, unlike the other cities or the neighboring cities on the continent and in the Peloponnese, which are populated by Doric immigrants, the Athenians considered themselves to be Ionians, and they considered themselves to be sort of indigenous of the land, having a special status. And, of course, that gave them a special bond with the Ionian cities, which was also why they got involved with the Ionian Revolt in 494, which, of course, eventually led to the destruction of the city. But it also led to the glory of Athens of the 5th century.
You win some, you lose some, right?
Yes.
All right. And then we follow the Pan-Athenaic Way from the Agora and all the way up to the hill where the Acropolis lies. And we enter through the massive Propylaea gateway, and suddenly here we are, the ancient Acropolis of Athens. And what structures are there to be seen here at the Acropolis?
So the Acropolis of today is sort of a strange place to go, because in many respects it's super well preserved, but on the other hand it's also just a shell of what it used to be. But we have to remember that, you know, it used to be, it's an architectural space, so it's dynamic, it changed constantly, and it changes all the time. Well, the thing is, in fact it hasn't changed in many years. It was excavated in the 19th century, and the focus was on the specific buildings from the second part of the 5th century. And everything else was just empty. It was just excavated down to the rock. So it was left with these empty ruins, reasonably well preserved, I would say, but nothing in between. And it didn't really develop for many years, but then 5 years ago, it must be now, they decided to put in a new path made from cement. And this created big scandal. A lot of people were very critical. The purpose of the path was actually to provide access to people in wheelchairs or people who have to walk with canes or have disabilities. But the fact that the sacred rock was changed was something that was unbelievable to many people. So obviously the Acropolis that you enter today is an icon. And it is related to many ancient necropoleis, many ancient phases, but it never looked like this. it didn't. But the dominant buildings are the building. They are original buildings. And the Parthenon, of course, is the biggest building on the Acropolis. But the Parthenon is an extraordinary building for many reasons. It did replace an earlier building, so it replaced an archaic building. But actually, the reason why it was constructed was because of a very important victory for the Athenians in 490, because the Ionian Revolt didn't go so well. And the Persians decided that they wanted to punish the Greek cities that had supported the revolt. This was Eretria and Athens. So 490, there was a Persian invasion. The Persians landed at Marathon, which is now very famous for this reason. The Athenians were greatly outnumbered. And of course, the Persian Empire, well, we normally call it the Persian Kingdom, but it was a superpower in its time. It was enormous and it consisted of multiple cities, fabulously rich, so a genuine superpower. And it wouldn't have been thought possible for the Athenians to get out of this dilemma, but they won. They won the Battle of Marathon, and that led to Athens making a place for itself, an important place for itself, when the second Persian invasion came. Of course, in the second Persian invasion, the Athenians had to give up Athens and Attica. Athens was destroyed, and the cities in Attica were also destroyed. So by the time the Greeks won, they came back to, you know, a city in ruins in 478, and they had to rebuild everything. So the Parthenon is in fact a gift to Athena, decided after 490. So after the Battle of Marathon, the Athenians decided to gift Athena with a huge monument to mirror the fantastic victory that they had won, and that obviously she had played an important part in. The early phases of this temple was destroyed, and then when the Athenians came back, they had to build a new temple. So imagine them, they come back to an entirely destroyed city, so there are many things that need to take place. And this grand restoration of the Acropolis, that only happens in the second half of the 5th century. And by then, Athens was super wealthy and super, super powerful. Athens was itself a superpower. All of that wealth and pride was poured into this building complex. So the Parthenon is the first temple entirely of marble. It's the most richly decorated temple in the Greek world. So it is very special.
And it's arguably the most famous monument, not just in Athens, but in ancient Greece as a whole, right? It's become sort of this symbol of democracy and Western civilization. But there are other monuments on the Acropolis, even though the Parthenon might outshine them at times. For example, the Erechtheion, which is the smaller temple to Athena on the north side of the Acropolis. And when thinking of it, you probably picture the Porch of the Maidens with the caryatid pillars. These pillars formed as young women. But a bit unlike the Parthenon, the Erechtheion has roots that go much deeper, possibly all the way back to the Mycenaean Bronze Age. So in the second millennium BC, right?
So it isn't really possible to make a direct continuity or to show a direct continuity between the Bronze Age and the historical Acropolis. So we must remember that the prehistorical Athens was a very different place, and it wasn't just one settlement. But there was, on the Acropolis, there was a Mycenaean palace. Like we know from Mycenae or Tiryns, probably not as complex and grand as those, but there was a Bronze Age palace. And if you go to the Acropolis, you can actually see the Bronze Age walls. The building program of the second half of the 5th century is located on top of this. Now, the Erechtheion is interesting because, unlike the Parthenon, which is a symmetrical building, which is what we expect of the Greek temples, the Erechtheion is completely asymmetrical. It is sort of three temples in one, with different parts differently organized. It's the most important temple because it is the house of Athena Polios. So it's the house of the patron goddess. It's where her cult image was kept. But it was also the house of many other cults. And it was used to house the cults of mythological kings. So that's why, in a sense, you could say that, yes, it does go back, or it draws on a remote past. Because again, the Athenians consider themselves to be autochthonous. So they were indigenous. That meant that they had ancestors going all the way back in time, which means that when walls, ancient walls, were visible, these were seen as direct evidence, of course, of direct ancestors. These older walls are actually incorporated in many places in the Acropolis because they, you can look on them as a window to the ancient past of the Athenians and this ancient heritage that the Athenians claim, unlike their Doric neighbors. The Nike Temple is even more obvious there because the Nike Temple, which is, of course, the Temple of Victory, but it's located at the point, the western point of the Acropolis. And in fact, it sits on this tiny promontory, which was an important part of the defensive feature of the Mycenaean Acropolis. Because the Mycenaeans, in their fortifications, they used to have gates, and they had gates with multiple gates, and they had these extended features that would allow them to sort of, when you have the enemy at the gate, you would be allowed to come behind the enemy and fire arrows on them from above. So this small promontory is actually a defensive feature in the Mycenaean fortification. In the classical period, when they rebuilt the Nike Temple, what they did was they actually extended the promontory. So it's a lot bigger now than it naturally, the rock is much smaller, but they extended it, possibly to get more space for the sanctuary itself. But what they did was they left two physical little windows in the terrace wall where you can see underneath the rock and the Mycenaean fortification. So clearly, this connection, this deep connection to the past, was very important to the Athenians. So although there's no direct continuity of purpose, you cannot say that this is a temple and there has been cult ever since the Mycenaean period at this particular point. We cannot say that. We don't have the evidence for that. It's very clear that they engage with the deep past in the way that they rebuilt the present at any given period, I would say.
And you mentioned the Temple of Athena Nike, or the Victorious Athena, right? Mm. Which was built over the old sanctuary of Athena Nike that was destroyed by the Persians in 480. And so, yeah, as you say, the Acropolis has been through these very many and different phases of building, destruction, and then rebuilding. And you already talked a little bit about it, but why do you think the people of Athens kept coming back to this place?
I think it has to do with this status that they claimed for themselves, that they were the original Ionians in a sea of Doric neighbors that had chased the other Ionian cities east. Athens and the Athenians claimed a special status on the Greek mainland. They had this special status. Their land was, in a sense, part of their community in a different way. And that's also why the Temple of Nike, there is a frieze. It actually tells four different stories. But the stories, the myths that are told, are all about foreign powers invading the Athenian territory. And of course, the Battle of Marathon is one of these. So there is, in fact, a frieze that shows the Persians and the Athenians and the Plataeans, because of course they did have a little bit of help fighting at the Battle of Marathon. So this is a historical event, but it's an event that had been raised to an almost mythical status, because normally temples would be decorated with mythical battles. But the Battle of Marathon in this way actually gets raised to the level of the mythical, immortal battles.
So they mythologized themselves,
sort of, right? Yes. Yeah. The thing about Greek myths, we all know a lot of Greek myths, and at some point they get canonized into a version that is now told by Disney, for instance. But actually, each individual city-state would have its own versions. So we all know about the Amazons and the Amazonomachia, which is, you know, the battle between Amazons and Greeks, is a very popular motive on temples. But in fact, there is an Athenian version and there are other versions. So different cities would have different versions and would embed themselves in the myths in different ways, and thereby creating a link to the past, and creating a link to the past in the age of the heroes when the gods walked the earth and there was a much closer relationship.
And you know, from up here on the Acropolis, you can see the whole of Athens laid out, stretching until the horizon, basically. What ancient thing is your favorite part of the city, seeing as you lived there for several years, right?
I suppose I have many favorites, but the Bronze Age fortification is in fact one of them, I must admit, because it's nowadays you see it mostly in glimpses, because for this huge monumental building program in the second half of the 5th century, they had to extend the rock considerably. So they filled in the frame, so to speak, and they built terrace walls. So the Bronze Age fortifications follow the natural rock. So it's much smaller. But because of the excavation, because they just cleared away all the soil, it is visible in many places. The Mycenaean city walls are built with these enormous stones that are not cut. They're sort of very rough, huge blocks, maybe 2 meters wide, put together, and it looks as if it's built from giants. Either built from giants or something that almost grew out of the rock. So it is very special, and it has a very different texture. So when you go to the Acropolis and these rock sections pop out to you, it feels very foreign and very different from all these polished white marble and, you know, finely cut decorated surfaces. So that's one of my favorites.
And if we then conclude our tour here at the peak of the Acropolis, can you give a final encouragement as to why people should visit Athens?
Time has a very special significance in Athens, and it's something that you can experience. So the Danish Institute is in Plaka. It sits on top of the ancient city. But in the middle of the square, you have to walk down 5 steps, is a church. Originally, the church was built in the 11th century, and it is the oldest active church. So it's not a museum. It's a church where you can go to a church service. And then in the corner, you can walk another 20 steps down, and there you have a Roman portico, which was part of the agora on this eastern side of the Acropolis. And you can actually see, when you look at the ground, you can see that there are older walls beneath. Athens, probably more than any other city I know, is a true palimpsest of all the different phases of life that has been lived in the city. They're all visible, you know, because now is now, and now can only be now. But in a sense, now is when you're standing in places like this, the entire past just sort of unfolds before you and sort of also makes promises of the future. So time is really dynamic and fluent in Athens, which is very special, I think.
Really one of those cities where you can dig deeper, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Great. What a good way to finish off this episode. Christina, thank you so much for joining today's episode. It's been an absolute blast having you.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, dear listener, for tuning in to this episode of Let's Dig Deeper. I hope that you've learned lots and that you're already packing your suitcase and booking a ticket to Athens. I know I, for one, can't wait to be back there. If you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, you can reach us at letsdigdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so that you never miss an episode. I'm Zinat Haroon, and I've been your host. You can reach me on Instagram, z_archaeology. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you next time, where we will dig deeper into another topic. Bye!